bombing might produce rubble in the streets of Dieppe that might possibly impede the advance of the troops off the beach. Therefore, air attacks were limited to a few quick strafing runs that may have caused the German defenders to duck briefly, but that left the main defenses untouched. The failures to employ paratroopers and to provide air or naval bombardment were terrible errors, and their absence at Dieppe would contrast sharply with the extremely heavy air and sea bombardments and extensive paratroop landings that would accompany later amphibious operations, such as those at D-Day. The British organizers of the Dieppe raid did have high hopes for another type of weapon, which played a central role in their schemes. This was a sizable contingent of Churchill tanks that they planned to land on the beach along with the soldiers. The Churchills were a brand new type of tank that had not yet been deployed in battle, and they were designed with heavier armor than previous models. Special boats were fabricated that could each carry three of these mighty armored vehicles and deposit them directly onto the beach. The tanks were supposed to accompany the first wave of infantry and to provide crucial fire support during the initial moments of the landing. They would then constitute an armored spearhead that would punch through the German defenses and quickly lead the infantry off of the dangerous open zone of the beach and on into the town. It all sounded good on paper, but the reality proved to be quite different. To begin with, the ships carrying the tanks got delayed, so the leading tanks did not arrive on the beach until a full 15 minutes after the infantry had already gone ashore. The first moments of an attack are the most crucial ones. It's important for an assault to maintain its momentum during that vital phase. Without the tanks, the unsupported infantry suffered heavier casualties, and by the time the tanks did show up, the attack had already bogged down and lost all of its momentum. And the men were now focused on seeking places of refuge to hide from the German gunners rather than thinking about pushing forward. Thus, the tanks had already failed in their primary purpose before they ever hit the beach. When they did land, an additional serious and unforeseen problem arose. The beach in front of Dieppe was composed of shingle. This is large, fist-sized, round stones. Because these stones were so large and loose, when the tanks attempted to drive forward, their treads could not get any traction. But instead, they just dug straight down into the shingle, excavating a pit and eventually immobilizing the tank and leaving it half buried in the stones. When the drivers tried pivoting sideways to try and get a purchase on the slippery surface, the rocks proved to be just the right size to be sucked up into the gap between the drive sprockets and the treads, where they wedged themselves in tightly. With the wheels jammed, usually one of the pins holding the treads together would then snap, causing the entire tread to come off. And again, the effect was to immobilize the vehicle. Several months before the raid, the Germans had surveyed the conditions on the beach, and they had come to the conclusion, now we know the British cannot land here with tanks. Unfortunately for the British, their intelligence assessment had not been as perceptive, and they had declared the beach well-suited for armored vehicles. About half the tanks quickly got stuck in the shingle, or were knocked out by the fusillade of German shellfire that rained down on them. Despite the formidable natural obstacle posed by the shingle, many of the tank drivers displayed considerable skill in coaxing their lumbering vehicles over this treacherous surface. So that of the 29 tanks that actually made it ashore, 15 did somehow manage to cross the beach and reach the firmer ground of the broad, grassy esplanade just beyond it. These tanks roared forward, eager to get at last to grips with their attackers, only to discover that every street leading into the town had been thoroughly blocked off with concrete barriers. In the original battle plan, these obstructions were supposed to be blown up by sappers carrying explosive charges. But most of the sappers had either been killed or were in the boats that never got to the beach. In fact, of the 169 sappers who did somehow get ashore, 152 were killed. Therefore, the 15 tanks ended up charging uselessly back and forth across the grassy field, all the while a constant hail of enemy shot pinged off their thick armor. The tanks tried to employ their cannon and machine guns to knock out enemy positions, but their guns were not powerful enough to destroy the well-fortified German emplacements which were hidden in caves or set behind thick concrete walls. One tank crewman described his vehicle's contribution to the raid as consisting of nothing more than going round and round in bloody circles, using up our gas and ammo, and being shelled. As they milled fruitlessly about in the open, they were easy targets, and one by one, the tanks were disabled by German artillery. Eventually, having utterly failed in their mission to help the infantry break out from the landing zone, the few surviving tanks ignominiously retreated back to the beach, where their most useful function became to serve as shields for the troops to cower behind. The main attack on the beach in front of Dieppe was a catastrophe. Far from landing and quickly advancing into the town, the entire force ended up being trapped on the beach, where they were steadily picked off by German gunners. Some enterprising groups of Canadians did force their way into the casino and managed to clear out the German troops there, but then they were unable to progress any further. Hundreds of corpses lay on the shingle or rolled around in the water, and the beach was littered with abandoned equipment and burning tanks, while in the surf were the shattered wrecks of landing craft that had been sunk while trying to discharge their cargoes. Offshore, the Allied commanders were slow to recognize how much of a disaster the landing had been, and they committed another error by electing to send in an additional wave of troops. It's an axiom of warfare not to reinforce failure, but this is exactly what they now did. Many of the new arrivals came ashore directly beneath one of the cliffs, where they were instantly decimated and then pinned down by withering fire from the Germans up on the heights. Thus, the reinforcements contributed nothing to the enterprise other than to raise the casualty count. The attacks had started just before dawn, but by mid-morning it had already become clear that they had failed miserably and that the only thing to do was to try and extricate as many of the survivors as possible. However, there does not seem to have been a coherent contingency plan for how to evacuate the men if the attacks failed to capture their objectives. And so many groups were simply marooned on the beaches. Furthermore, at the request of the Air Force, the time for the evacuation was delayed by 1 hour. And that decision had tragic consequences, since some of the landing zones were overrun during that added interval, and all the men there killed or captured. Also, the chance to save a large number of troops was lost when, partly due to a garbled communication, a sizable contingent of vessels that could have been used to take men off the beaches prematurely gave up the attempt and sailed back to England, empty. Many of the remaining boats became overcrowded and were sunk. By the afternoon, those soldiers still alive on the beaches were forced to surrender. Total Allied casualties exceeded 4,000, and over 80% of the troops who had landed on the beaches had been lost. The Germans were astounded by the raid's poor execution, and they were puzzled as to what the Allies had hoped to accomplish by it. When interrogating one of the captured Canadians, a thoroughly mystified German officer was moved to exclaim, "Too big for a raid, too small for an invasion. What were you trying to do?" It was an appropriate question. From conception to execution, the Dieppe raid was a wretched affair, full of erroneous estimates, unclear objectives, poor planning, and sloppy execution. The only bright spot was the considerable valor displayed by the unfortunate men caught up in the debacle. 3 Victoria Crosses were granted, along with a slew of lesser awards. The Canadians had amply proven their bravery and initiative while under fire. It was retroactively claimed, particularly by Mountbatten and Churchill, that the hard lessons learned at Dieppe were well worth their high cost, because they contributed to the much superior planning that went into the D-Day invasion 2 years later. There's probably some truth to this. Certainly, Dieppe showed the need for better cooperation among air, naval, and ground units, as well as for intense air and naval bombardment prior to the landings. And these were lessons that were all successfully applied at D-Day. The failure of the tanks may also have encouraged the development of these specialized vehicles employed at D-Day. Nevertheless, many of these supposed lessons should have been fairly obvious. And there were numerous other amphibious landings, such as those in the Mediterranean, which gave the Allies experience with this type of attack. Even if the Dieppe raid was doomed from the outset, the scale of the disaster that occurred there was avoidable and unforgivable.
Lecture 23, Operation Market Garden, A Bridge Too Far.
Early on the afternoon of September 17th, 1944, the inhabitants of the sleepy little towns of central Holland witnessed an astounding event that has never been equaled either before or since. Tens of thousands of greenish-yellow parachutes blossomed in the skies over their neatly tended houses and cottages. From the open doorways of 1,000 transport planes, more than 20,000 heavily laden British and American paratroopers tumbled out to begin their perilous descent to the earth. Meanwhile, nearly 500 large, ungainly gliders cast free of the tow aircraft and swooped down to alight heavily in the wet fields like a flock of gigantic geese. Once on the ground, the fat gliders disgorged 14,000 more troops, as well as 2,000 vehicles. Each of the 2 columns of planes carrying the soldiers constituted a solid mass of aircraft that was 94 miles long and 3 miles wide. Around these large transports buzzed a swarm of 1,000 nimble fighter planes, and the arrival of the entire force had been preceded by airstrikes from an additional 1,500 bombers and fighters. So astonishing was the sight of this massive aerial armada that even the German defenders were momentarily paralyzed with wonder and envy at its scale. The German general who was commanding the region later wrote that he and his staff stood awestruck on the balcony of their headquarters and simply stared, stunned like fools. "This mighty spectacle deeply impressed me. I thought with longing of our own airborne operations. Oh, if ever I'd had such means at my disposal, just once to have this many planes. He was right to be impressed, for it was indeed the largest airborne assault of all time. The men and aircraft that darkened the skies over Holland on that day in the early autumn of 1944 were part of a bold Allied offensive that was designated Operation Market Garden, and its ambitious goal was nothing less than achieving complete victory in Europe by the end of the year. The origins of Operation Market Garden lay in the events that unfolded in the aftermath of the Allied invasion of Europe on D-Day. The Allies had assumed that once their beachheads in Normandy were established, the British and American armies would make steady progress, overrunning German opposition in France and pushing on into Germany itself. The Germans, however, put up unexpectedly stiff resistance, and the offensive bogged down for weeks among the dense hedgerows of Normandy, where little pockets of German troops and tanks could lie in wait and ambush advancing Allied columns. Finally, though, as summer gave way to fall, the British troops in the north, under the command of Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, at last broke through and drove towards Holland. Meanwhile, to the south, an American army, led by the notoriously aggressive general George S. Patton, similarly stabbed across central France and raced toward the German frontier. Now, Montgomery and Patton had long been rivals, and however talented, both men were egotistical and glory-seeking. Each one now demanded the lion's share of the limited amount of available logistical support, so that his own army could be the one to penetrate into Germany and bring the war to an end. It was a race for fame and glory, and both men were determined to win it. The Allies overconfidently believed that the Germans were now beaten, and the only remaining question was who would collect the spoils. In launching attacks, Montgomery was normally extremely cautious, sometimes overly so. Now, however, maybe because he was spurred on by fear that his arch-rival Patton would get to Germany first, Montgomery came up with an atypically daring scheme that would enable his army to win the race. The main barrier between his forces and Germany proper was the many rivers, including the Rhine itself, that flowed through Holland and emptied out into the North Sea. The bridges spanning these water obstacles form natural choke points, and whoever controlled these controlled the doorways that led into Germany. Montgomery's plan centered around these bridges. It called for a colossal airborne assault that would deposit 40,000 troops by parachute and glider, who would descend from the sky and seize a chain of seven of these vital strategic bridges. The furthest of the targets was a full 64 miles behind enemy lines, meaning that each of the contingents of troops holding its designated bridge would be isolated deep within enemy territory. A powerful ground army, spearheaded by tanks, would then advance rapidly forward on a narrow front towards the first of those bridges. Upon reaching it, the airborne troops there would be relieved, and the ground army would cross the bridge and drive for the next one. That sequence would be repeated until the last bridge, which spanned the Rhine River at the town of Arnhem, was reached. Once across the Arnhem Bridge, Montgomery would have his coveted entryway into Germany. One of the generals involved in planning the operation described it in this way. The object is to lay down a carpet of airborne troops over which our ground forces can pass. The airborne landing component was codenamed Market, while the thrust of 30 Corps, which was the ground army, was labeled Garden. Therefore, the combined plan was referred to as Operation Market Garden. It was a bold concept, but one fraught with potential dangers. Due to weight restrictions, the airborne troops would have to drop with a limited amount of equipment and supplies, so they would be fairly lightly armed when they confronted the enemy. Not only would they have to successfully seize the sequence of bridges, but then they would also have to resist all German counterattacks long enough for the ground column to reach them. If more heavily armed German troops got to them before 30 Corps, they could all easily be massacred. A central component of the plan, therefore, was speed. The Allies knew that the lightly armed airborne troops could only hold out for a few days at most, and so it was essential that 30 Corps advance as quickly as possible. The timetable called for 30 Corps to arrive at the furthest airborne troops, the ones who were holding the crucial Rhine Bridge at Arnhem, within 48 hours. The task given to 30 Corps was complicated by the fact that their main route of advance was a single narrow road. Much of Holland, of course, was soft, marshy land, completely unsuited for tanks. And so the majority of the armored spearhead would have to come down that one road. With 30 Corps confined to that restricted pathway, the Germans could easily set up strong points along the road to block their advance. All the Germans had to do to thwart the entire plan was cut this tenuous route, or even just delay 30 Corps with ambushes long enough for the airborne troops to be overrun. Even worse, long stretches of this roadway were elevated up above the surrounding fields on a raised embankment. To the German gunners, the British tanks proceeding in single file along this raised roadway would resemble a row of ducks in a shooting gallery, conveniently silhouetted against the sky and incapable of maneuvering effectively. Perhaps the biggest potential flaw in the plan was that if any one part failed, then the entire operation would collapse. If just one of the airborne contingents did not manage to grab its assigned bridge, then the chain would be broken, and 30 Corps would be unable to reach the next bridge. Even if all the bridges were successfully seized, if 30 Corps moved too slowly and one of them were recaptured, again, the whole thing would fall apart. One worried British officer noted that the operation would be like threading seven needles with one piece of cotton, and we have only to miss one to be in trouble. Finally, everything hinged on the most difficult part of the scheme. This is because the big prize, the one that really mattered, was the Arnhem Bridge over the Rhine. Even if all the other bridges were taken, if the Arnhem Bridge was not held, or if 30 Corps couldn't reach it, then all the other successes would really be in vain. There's an often repeated story that when planning Market Garden, one of the British generals was concerned about their ability to take and hold the Arnhem Bridge. And he remarked to Montgomery that he feared Arnhem would prove to be a bridge too far. The sources for this comment are somewhat uncertain, but the phrase, a bridge too far, has become indelibly associated with Operation Market Garden, and it was used as the title both for a best-selling book and a star-studded epic movie about the battle. Preparations for Market Garden proceeded at an accelerated pace, and the operation took on a irresistible momentum that squashed any attempts to try to question its wisdom. The most famous of these occurred when a British intelligence officer deduced that several high-quality German units might have been placed in the region right around Arnhem for refitting. Market Garden's planners had assumed that the region would only be lightly defended by troops of very poor quality. And so the presence of good combat soldiers, along with their heavy equipment, such as armored vehicles, that would be a sound reason to rethink the whole attack. On his own initiative, the intelligence officer had some reconnaissance aircraft fly over the area and take photos. And sure enough, these revealed the presence of German tanks. Justifiably alarmed by this revelation, he rushed to the general in charge with the photos, only to receive the dismissive reply, "I should not worry. The reports were probably wrong. And in any case, the German troops were refitting and not up to much fighting." Apparently to prevent him from coming up with any more inconvenient evidence that might stop Market Garden from being launched, the intelligence officer was then abruptly informed that it had been determined that he was suffering from nervous strain and exhaustion, and that he had to go on leave or else face a court-martial. On September 17th, the thousands of aircraft bearing the airborne forces lumbered into the skies and headed for their drop zones in Holland. There were three main landing sites. American troops of the 101st Airborne Division alighted near the town of Eindhoven, 13 miles behind enemy lines, and they were charged with seizing three bridges there. The U.S. 82nd Airborne Division was dropped 53 miles behind the front line near Nijmegen and also had three bridges to capture and hold. Finally, the British 1st Airborne Division was deposited near Arnhem, 63 miles deep in enemy territory, and it was tasked with taking the vital Arnhem Bridge. The Eindhoven and Nijmegen landings met with mixed success. Some of the bridges were quickly seized by the American paratroopers, but several were blown up by the Germans before they could be captured. Meanwhile, 30 Corps had begun to push along the road to open up a corridor and reach the embattled airborne troops. Predictably, the going was tougher than expected, and German attacks delayed the advance. By the end of the first day, 30 Corps had only managed to progress a total of 7 miles. Now, no operation goes perfectly, and despite these setbacks, the overall goals of Market Garden were still quite attainable. It had taken longer than planned, but by dawn of September 19th, 30 Corps had passed Eindhoven, and the first group of airborne troops watched with relief as the British tanks rolled across the bridges that they had fought for. Even the problem of some bridges having been blown up was successfully solved. Knowing that the Germans were likely to try to destroy the river crossings, 30 Corps was accompanied by a large group of engineers, equipped with prefabricated sections that could be joined together to make a temporary bridge, at least over narrower water obstacles. Such a contraption was known as a Bailey Bridge, and by working feverishly through the night, the engineers erected one of these over the Wilhelmina Canal, where the original bridge had been destroyed by the Germans. At Nijmegen, located in the second main landing zone, American soldiers had failed to seize the far side of the key bridge during the initial assault. In a desperate attempt to fulfill their assignment, they now undertook a perilous crossing of the river, paddling over in small boats while being subjected to a deadly rain of German cannon and machine gun fire. Although they suffered heavy losses, their bravery and determination paid off, and they managed to capture the other end of the bridge and thereby secure the next stepping stone along the route to Arnhem. By nightfall on September 20th, 30 Corps had linked up with them too, and now was ready to undertake the final drive from Nijmegen to Arnhem. They had traversed about 55 miles and were within just 10 miles of the ultimate prize, the bridge at Arnhem. The operation was right on the verge of achieving its objectives and being a stunning success. However, 30 Corps was supposed to have reached Arnhem in 2 days, and already 4 had passed. Would they be too late? Let's see what had been happening at Arnhem during all this time that 30 Corps was slowly bashing its way through Eindhoven and Nijmegen. The British airborne troops assigned to Arnhem were at a disadvantage from the very start, because the Royal Air Force, which operated the planes that would transport them, insisted that the men be dropped in some fields that were a full 8 to 10 miles outside the town. Their rationale for depositing the men so far from their target was due to a mixture of reasons, ranging from the claim that there were no suitable fields closer in, to a desire to avoid concentrations of German anti-aircraft guns. In retrospect, dropping the men at such a remote location was asking for trouble, and surely at least some of them could have been deposited much nearer the target. But in the general rush to mount the operation, there was no time for proper reflection. Once on the ground, the men found themselves almost entirely unable to communicate, either among their scattered detachments or with higher command. And this was because they had been issued with radios that either lacked the necessary range or were incorrectly tuned. Because of a shortage of available transport aircraft, a large percentage of the force could not arrive with the first wave, but would have to be brought in on subsequent days. Furthermore, many of the men who did land could not participate in the actual assault on the Arnhem Bridge because they would have to stay at these distant drop sites to guard them and hold them for those later arrivals. Thus, the men charged with seizing the main target of the whole operation would be severely under strength. Although airborne reconnaissance could have enabled the mission planners to provide the men with detailed street maps of Arnhem, which would have been an extremely useful asset, no such maps were prepared. And the ones that the paratroopers were actually given showed no detail at all within the town, rendering them more or less worthless. Finally, shortly after landing, the British general in charge of the airborne troops attacking Arnhem effectively removed himself from control of the battle when he rather unwisely went forward in person to try to assess the situation, only to find himself cut off from his men. He ended up being forced to hide in the attic of a friendly Dutch family, and he was trapped there overnight when a German armored vehicle happened to park outside. Although he eventually escaped and made it back to the main body of his troops, for 39 hours, nearly the entirety of the critical first 2 days on the ground, the men at Arnhem were deprived of their commander's leadership. Most of the groups assigned to seize the Arnhem Bridge ran into contingents of German troops while they were trying to move from the drop zone toward the target. And rather than just pushing on, they got bogged down in fighting. One battalion, however, under the command of Colonel John Frost, aggressively just forced their way past the defending Germans and refused to be distracted by them. Frost's men reached the north end of the Arnhem Bridge around 9 p.m. on the first day. When they then tried to advance across it in order to seize the southern end, they encountered heavy opposition, and so they drew back and they established themselves in the buildings which surrounded the north end of the bridge, and they began to fortify these. With his own battalion supplemented by stragglers from various other groups, Frost eventually found himself in command of a total of about 750 men. No significant reinforcements would reach Frost after this, and over the next several days, the Germans repeatedly attacked his small pocket of men. They fought back tenaciously, clinging stubbornly to their little cluster of buildings around the north end of the bridge. The lightly armed paratroopers even managed to defeat an attack by a squadron of German armored cars, half-tracks, and light tanks. After getting over their initial shock, the Germans responded well to Market Garden, organizing their nearby troops into a series of ad hoc battle formations and launching counterattacks. Some German battle groups threatened to sever the narrow corridor, which was being held by 30 Corps at various points along its length, while others formed up between Nijmegen and Arnhem to try to prevent 30 Corps from advancing any further. Still others surrounded Frost and his little band of men at the bridge, as well as the rest of the British paratroopers outside of Arnhem, and they set about wiping out these isolated pockets. Over the next several days, from September 20th to the 24th, battles raged at all of these points. 30 Corps got to within just a few miles of linking up with the troops at Arnhem, but by then, German resistance was increasing and their reinforcements were arriving. While on the other hand, the exhausted Allied troops were running low on ammunition and other critical supplies. The airborne troops at the north end of the Arnhem Bridge held on for 3 long days, with nearly all of them, including Frost himself, being wounded. After a heroic defense, with ammunition and water gone, they were at last overcome. The main body of British troops who landed near Arnhem established a defensive position at the adjacent town of Oosterbeek, and they continued fighting. But their casualties steadily mounted, while the perimeter they held continued to shrink. A ill-advised attempt to reinforce them with Polish paratroopers only added to the number of trapped men. Most of the desperately needed supplies that the Air Force tried to drop to these men went astray and actually fell into German hands. For example, during one resupply attempt, out of 390 tons of supplies that were dropped, only 21 tons fell on territory controlled by the British, while 369 tons were snatched up by the delighted Germans. With 30 Corps stopped in its tracks and the Arnhem Bridge still securely held by the Germans, Operation Market Garden had failed. Reluctantly acknowledging this fact, the Allied High Command made the decision to evacuate the surviving airborne troops across the river, and this was accomplished during the night of September 25th using small boats. Of the approximately 10,000 men who had landed near Arnhem, only about 2,200 escaped. Total Allied casualties for Operation Market Garden were close to 17,000. German losses are uncertain, but they were likely less than one-third that number. With the failure of Market Garden, all hopes of bringing the war to a close by the end of 1944 died. The Germans, in fact, turned out to be very far from beaten. And in December, they unleashed their powerful counteroffensive in the Ardennes Forest. This, of course, is an operation that has come to be known as the Battle of the Bulge. It would not be until the spring of 1945 that Allied troops would finally advance through Holland, with Arnhem itself being liberated in mid-April. Operation Market Garden is routinely listed among the great military mishaps of World War II. And in terms of casualties sustained for results gained, it was undoubtedly a disaster. Additionally, as we've seen, the Allies made numerous errors in planning, organization, and execution. From ignoring important intelligence, to badly chosen drop sites, to unrealistic timetables, to grossly underestimating the resistance that the Germans would offer. There's no shortage of mistakes that one can point to and blame for its failure. I do believe, however, that Market Garden does not deserve as much condemnation as many of the other military blunders that we've examined. While it unquestionably failed, and many mistakes were certainly made, it at least had a clear and worthy objective that might have exerted a great impact on the course of the war. Furthermore, despite all the errors of the Allies, it actually came fairly close to succeeding. The all-important bridgehead across the Rhine was nearly reached, with 30 Corps falling only a few miles short of its objective. Or if the Arnhem assault had been better organized and coordinated, the bridge could potentially have been captured and held long enough for 30 Corps to break through to it. While analyzing all the plan's flaws, one can still admire its boldness. And it's interesting to observe how thin the margin can sometimes be that separates a brilliant success from an appalling disaster. As a final note on this battle, it's fitting that today, the rebuilt bridge over the Rhine in Arnhem that was the focal point of such fierce fighting is now known as John Frost's Bridge.
Lecture 24, The Great Blunders, Four Paths to Failure.
Alexander the Great of Macedon is universally regarded as one of the greatest military commanders of all time. But in 325 BC, near the modern city of Multan in Pakistan, this normally brilliant general did something incredibly stupid. It was 9 years into his epic march across Europe and Asia, and he had already vanquished the enormous Persian Empire and subjugated nearly the entire known world. But not content with this, Alexander had then ventured into unknown territory, invading Afghanistan, crossing the Hindu Kush, and conquering northern India. His current foe was the Malians, inhabitants of the Indus Valley, and Alexander had already bested their field army and driven them back into the refuge of a double-walled fortress. As he watched the siege, Alexander became impatient with the pace of the assault, and so seizing a ladder out of the hands of one of his startled soldiers, Alexander climbed to the top of the outer wall and stood there in plain sight of everyone. This was a typical Alexander gesture, one that displayed both his courage and his willingness to share the tasks of his men, and they loved him for it. While occupying this position exposed him to the enemy fire, it was a deed of calculated boldness that inspired his men to follow him and press home the attack. Now, though, he did something that shocked even those accustomed to his routine acts of bravery. With his purpose of encouraging his troops accomplished, he should have simply hopped back down outside the wall and overseen the completion of the siege. Instead, Alexander did something unbelievably rash. He jumped down, alone, into the enemy city. This suicidal exploit left even his usually admiring ancient biographers stunned and critical. Quintus Curtius Rufus's description of the scene is typical. He wrote, "At this point, Alexander made an astounding and unheard-of move, which did far more to enhance his reputation for recklessness than it added to his record of glory. With a wild leap, he threw himself down into a city full of his enemies." Alexander's horrified soldiers flung themselves against the fortress, desperate to save their beloved general. Meanwhile, on the other side of the wall, Alexander was surrounded and fighting for his life. As he slashed wildly at the circle of foes, a massive 3-foot arrow slammed into his chest, penetrating his armor and piercing his lung. With blood gushing from the terrible wound, Alexander slumped to his knees, and his jubilant enemies closed in for the kill. It seemed that the normally brilliant Alexander had finally overreached, and that his impetuous and foolhardy decision to jump into the enemy fortress would prove to be a fatal error. We'll return to Alexander later. But before we do that, let's reflect on the theme of military disasters in general, and on the impressive variety of mistakes that we've witnessed over the last 23 lectures. The eminent contemporary military historian John Keegan has written that all battles are, in some degree, disasters, in the sense that military conflicts inevitably involve death and destruction. This statement is certainly true. But despite their often terrible cost in lives and resources, many battles are nevertheless still regarded as great triumphs. Obviously, the winning side in a conflict might be predisposed to view it in a positive light, while the reverse is true for the losers. But even when allowing for this difference in perspective, there are certain military events that are nearly universally excoriated as blunders. So what sets these apart for special condemnation? One possible answer is that for a military defeat to qualify as a true blunder, it has to be avoidable. In other words, someone had to make a decision or perform an action that dramatically altered the outcome for the worse. Moreover, that choice or deed had to be one that common sense, training, or circumstance strongly suggested was unwise. In this interpretation, losing a battle simply because one was outnumbered or outmatched or even suffered random misfortune is not alone enough to qualify it as a blunder. In order to be counted as a true blunder, somewhere along the line, someone had to make a terrible decision. Someone had to do something foolish, or in some cases, someone had to fail to take an obvious action. Thus, genuine blunders also involve an element of blame. We can point a finger and say that a critical mistake was definitely made. The easiest target for such censure is individuals, usually the commanders. But sometimes the agent of the mishap is more amorphous. At times, the prevailing cultural expectations or prejudices of an institution or a society can create an atmosphere that inevitably leads to poor choices or misguided actions by an entire group. Thus, blunders can result either from acts or decisions taken on the spur of the moment by one person, or they can arise from deeper, underlying, structural flaws that may have been decades in the making. Of course, in reality, the causation of military blunders is often more complex than just a single factor. And most military disasters are the consequence of multiple mistakes. Frequently, these errors compound or build upon one another, forming a chain of miscalculations culminating in catastrophe. Nevertheless, it's worthwhile attempting to identify key moments or decisions that did more than others to ensure tragedy. Let's look back over the conflicts that we've covered in this course in order to determine some of the major recurrent errors that have led to these awful blunders. And by so doing, construct a kind of typology of military failures. Four general categories that these mistakes fall into are failures of planning, failures of leadership, failures of execution, and failures of adaptation. The first group, failures of planning, encompasses decisions or omissions that effectively doom one side even before battle is actually joined. Beginning with the broadest perspective, Such failures can occur at the strategic level, when the goals or objectives for an entire operation are either unclear or poorly chosen. Sometimes even attempting a military operation is a poor decision, because any benefits that might be gained through success are disproportionately outweighed by the potential losses that could be incurred by failure. An ancient example of this is the Sicilian expedition that attacked Syracuse, in which Athens unwisely overreached by committing the majority of its forces in pursuit of a dubious objective that was really just a sideshow to the main conflict with Sparta. When the expedition was destroyed, Athens lost both its empire and the larger war. Another example of an ill-conceived goal was the Italian campaign to annex Ethiopia, which was driven more by the government's desire to appear to be a first-rank colonial power than by any rational military or economic gains that might have resulted from success. The World War II raid on Dieppe reveals a number of errors in planning. From the start, its overall goals were hazy. The blueprint for the raid was excessively complex, and the specific objectives for the various landings were wildly over-optimistic. When predictably things went wrong, there were no contingency plans for evacuating the troops, producing excessive casualties. Another common contributor to disaster that occurs at the planning stage is the failure to gather proper intelligence. Not adequately scouting out the Boer positions at Colenso, which contributed to the subsequent botched assaults, illustrates this point. A related, but perhaps even worse, flaw is deliberately ignoring information that contradicts what the planners of an operation want to believe. In the Victorian era, the horrific massacre during the retreat from Kabul had its origins in Lord Auckland's willful disregard of the reports and recommendations that he received from his knowledgeable agents in the field. And a century later, during the lead-up to Operation Market Garden, the warnings that there were high-quality German units in the neighborhood of Arnhem were similarly discounted. One very specific planning error that shows up in a surprising number of the cases that we've looked at is the failure to take into account the particular characteristics of the terrain on which an army will operate or where a battle will take place. Thus, at Courtrai, the wet, marshy field broke the momentum of the heavily armored French knights and made them vulnerable to the crude but effective weapons of the Flemish shopkeepers. Other battles in which neglecting to make allowances for the landscape brought disaster to one side include Carrhae, Khalkha, Red Cliffs, Kabul, Napoleon's invasion of Russia, Tannenberg, Gallipoli, and Arnhem. A second broad category of error is failures of leadership. The simplest and probably most common form that these take is incompetence. All too often in the history of warfare, a general has been given a task for which he is wholly unfit. A prime example can be found in the sad story of the retreat from Kabul, in which the constant dithering and poor decisions of the elderly, infirm, indecisive, and generally inept General Elphinstone effectively sealed the fate of thousands of his soldiers. Sometimes it's the case that a normally competent leader is confronted by a situation that proves to be beyond his abilities. When the renowned Chinese general Cao Cao had to try to conduct a campaign on the water rather than on land, his usual competence failed him. And when the previously solid Roman general Crassus was forced to deal with the highly mobile and deadly horse archers of Parthia, he was unable to rise to the task. These vividly illustrate the truism that it's important to know one's limitations, and that proven success in one sphere does not always translate to another. Another extremely widespread failure of leadership that that often affects even the most skilled and experienced generals is overconfidence. Valens at Adrianople, Napoleon in Russia, and the British at Gallipoli are all memorable examples. Such instances of having an inflated opinion of one's own abilities are often coupled with a corresponding lack of respect for one's opponent. Underestimating the enemy can be an especially costly mistake. Generals facing foes whom they regard as representing a lesser civilization or who possess inferior technology are particularly prone to falling into this dangerous mindset. Custer's arrogant belief that he could defeat any number of Native Americans and Chelmsford's disregard for the threat posed by the Zulus caused both men to lead their troops to destruction. This can be a tricky quality to assess, since a successful general needs to possess a healthy measure of confidence in order to inspire his men and avoid indecisiveness, but yet must not carry this too far so that it veers into the territory of unfounded hubris. This same tension applies to many of the other positive qualities of the best commanders. For instance, while boldness is a common characteristic of great generals, when it becomes rashness, this can be a fatal flaw. The third category is failures of execution, which are most typically manifested as tactical errors on the battlefield. One example that we've seen a number of times happens when a commander unwisely divides his army, allowing it to be destroyed piecemeal. Again, Custer at Little Bighorn and Chelmsford at Isandlwana were both guilty of this. In other instances, a clever enemy can produce the same effect. At the Battle of the Kalka River, the Mongols deliberately enticed the overeager Russians into spreading out their forces, resulting in their being picked off one by one. A variant of this error occurs when control of the army is split among several different generals, creating an unclear chain of command. If, as seems all too often the case, the generals are rivals or personally dislike one another, such a divided command becomes a recipe for certain disaster. The animosity between the leaders of the British Army and Navy contingents during the campaign to capture Cartagena produced a veritable comedy of errors that unfortunately ended in tragedy for their men. The branches of an armed service should work together smoothly, but inter-service rivalries frequently rear up to sabotage an operation, as at Gallipoli or Arnhem. Another type of battlefield error involves failures in communication. These might arise from orders that were unclear in the first place, as at the Battle of the Crater or Adwa, or they could be due to technological inadequacies, such as those which plague the two Russian armies at the Battle of Tannenberg. Perhaps one of the most infamous examples of how miscommunication can lead to disaster is, of course, the charge of the Light Brigade. There, the lack of clarity of Raglan's orders was made worse by his choice of an untrained messenger to convey them, and the personal rivalry between Cardigan and Raglan prevented them from cooperating to properly decipher the orders. A final sort of failure of execution is the inability to recognize when to cut one's losses and to call off an unsuccessful operation. Napoleon could have extricated most of his army from Russia, but he lingered too long in Moscow and missed the chance. At Syracuse, Gallipoli, and Dieppe, the leadership made the mistake of sending in additional forces to an operation that had already clearly gone irretrievably wrong. In each case, rather than accepting moderate casualties and living to fight another day, they reinforced failure.